Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
For all of our listeners in the Northwest Georgia area, join us tomorrow, August 16th, for an undisclosed podcast meetup at the Swift & Finch Coffee Shop in Rome, Georgia, starting at 6 p.m. I'll be there along with Claire Gilbert from the Georgia Innocence Project, and we hope to see you there.
Welcome, everybody, to the sixth episode of the second season of Undisclosed. We've got three great sponsors this week: Blue Apron, The Great Courses, and Stamps.com. As always, support our sponsors because they support us. And hey, I've got one more ask for you, but I want to explain what that is in the credits. So do me a favor. After the show, stick around and listen to what I have to say. We really need our fan support. Until then, enjoy the show.
Last we checked in, the Rome City Police Department had realized a couple of things. First, that Isaac Dawkins' death wasn't caused by an accident. He died from a bullet wound to the head. And second, that it seemed the most likely suspect, according to Breanne and other rumors, was Joey Watkins. But while Rome Police Department was the agency that began the investigation, they weren't the ones who actually completed it. For the first 7 weeks, though, they were in the lead. It wouldn't be until almost 2 months later that the investigation got turned on its head when another agency took over. Hi and welcome to episode 6 of Undisclosed, The State versus Joey Watkins. This week's episode is Jurisdiction Friction. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and I'm here with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
I'm Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney with the Volkov Law Group, and I blog at viewfromll2.com.
I'm Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog. According to the website TVTropes.org, one classic television trope is jurisdiction friction. The website says that this occurs when two or more law enforcement organizations both can lay claim on a particular criminal case or suspect that will rarely see eye to eye on the best way to prosecute slash investigate the case. In the U.S., local cops versus the federal government, FBI, DEA, etc. is the most common setup. Usually the locals will want to shut down a petty crook to protect their town and the little guy, while the feds are focused on the big picture and would rather he go free so they can focus on building a case against the big fish higher up in the criminal ladder. When a case is particularly sensitive or difficult, the friction may be reversed. Each group of investigators wants to absolve themselves of jurisdiction to avoid the problems that will come with it. This is most likely to happen if one of the groups is under pressure to improve their conviction rate and does not want to risk taking on a case they cannot solve. Which side of the dispute is sympathetic and which is heartless, slash incompetent, slash arrogant, slash corrupt, slash trigger happy, slash working for the shadow government depends entirely on who the main characters are. FBI agents serious such as the X-Files and Without a Trace naturally will have them in the right, while a police procedural like Law and Order is frequently on the other side. Now, we see this trope in all types of TV shows running the spectrum from Law and Order to the X-Files, but it actually rarely occurs in real life. When it does, though, it rarely goes well. And in real life, unlike in TV shows, there's usually no clear divide between the sympathetic faction and the unsympathetic one. More often, there are failures to communicate that can all be shared. Probably the most famous example involves former LAPD officer Christopher Dorner. In 2013, after Dorner went on a killing spree, Irvine PD wanted jurisdiction because Dorner committed two murders in their borders, LAPD wanted jurisdiction because Dorner had threatened many LAPD officers, and San Bernardino wanted jurisdiction because Dorner killed one of their deputies. The manhunt for Dorner extended out to 12 days, and a 120-page report ultimately concluded there were too many officers and not enough talking. In the Joey Watkins case, the jurisdiction friction was subtler, and on the surface, all sides tried to play it off as a friendly arrangement, something that everyone wanted.
There have been hundreds more people interviewed by us and by the city. We put a whole entire team on it. So some of the things that they found out, instead of it happened this way, we approved, otherwise it didn't happen. And so there, it's a joint investigation. It's not county against city. It's we have a team that's working this thing.
But there was tension there between the Rome Police and the Floyd County Police. It seeps through from the polite and carefully written letters sent between the two departments, and from the less polite and less carefully written references to the other department in each side's notes, in their internal memos, and in private conversations. It's also clear that, eventually, the Rome Police Department was seeking to wash its hands of the entire case, or at least minimize its involvement, or to downplay whatever the Rome police officers may have done, and to lay any blame or accolades alike, as may have been deserved, at the feet of the county and not the city.
Marshal, as I recall, the city was sometime in developing leads on this case, were they not?
That's correct, sir.
And in fact, the city police did not make any arrest on this case.
That's correct, sir.
All right, that's when the county got involved in it.
No, it was somewhat a little bit before that when the county got involved. It was like, well before an arrest was made.
Okay. I'm saying. I'm not trying to make the city look bad, but no one from the city was involved in that part of it.
That's correct.
But at the beginning, this was the Rome Police Department's case. And differences between the two jurisdictions, between the Rome Police Department and the Floyd County Police Department, can be seen from the very different ways in which they each conducted their investigation.
So here's how it went down. Because Isaac's truck was wrecked in the Rome city limits, his murder was initially investigated by the Rome City Police. And although Rome City shares its jurisdiction with the Floyd County Police Department because it's in the county, crimes that happen within the city are typically dealt with by the city police. As a result, Detective Jim Moser with the Rome Police Department became the lead investigator in the Isaac Dawkins case, and he would head the investigation for the first 7 weeks. Now, Joby was an immediate and strong subject of interest for the investigation. After all, he was the one that Isaac's friends and family said had the motive to do it. But the problem was, a motive was all they had. Brianne's stories about how Joey wanted to kill Isaac due to his obsession with her gave them a place to start, but that's also pretty much where the RPD's case against Joey ended. Other than that, they had a lot of people saying Joey could have done it, and a lot of people saying they'd heard Joey had done it, but nothing to show he actually did do it. So while the existence of Brianne as a supposed motive made Joey an initial suspect, the Rome police didn't limit their investigation to him. A half dozen other suspects were also considered, and they were investigated at least to some degree. But that would all stop on February 28, 2000, when investigator Stanley Sutton with the Floyd County Police Department took over the case. In many respects, the first 7 weeks of the investigation into Isaac's death looked like an entirely different case from the last 8 months of it. In the first 7 weeks, RPD never had a conception of how Joey might have committed the crime, and it entertained a lot of possible scenarios as to what might have actually happened that resulted in Isaac's death. But in the last 8 months, from when Sutton took over on February 28th until November 13th, when Joey was arrested, investigators would not consider a single scenario that did not involve Joey being culpable for Isaac's death, one way or the other. But they collected evidence about a dozen different and mutually exclusive narratives as to how he might have done it. But all that would come later. In this episode, we'll cover what the Rome police found in their investigation into Joey before the case was taken over by Floyd County at the end of February. They found ballistics evidence, they spoke to the few witnesses to the murder, and then tried to link Joey to the evidence they'd recovered. But they wouldn't succeed in doing so. Now, we're going to take a short break so we can hear about one of our amazing sponsors.
Thanks, Rabia. Hey, I want to take the time now to say that I'm proud of you. Not so much for your many accomplishments, everybody knows about that, but for being so humble in defeat in our Blue Apron cooking battle. You've really taken it like a sport, and I'm proud of you for that. You know that I've outcooked you using the variety of delicious Blue Apron meals sent my way, and that I'm going to continue to do it through the month of August. Basically, my plan is to cook those meals with Blue Apron because it's easy and fun. Take a picture of what I cook, put it up on Twitter, and then make fun of you. Afterwards, I'll eat, it'll be delicious, and I'll be happy. So that said, I want our fans to continue to follow me and Rabia's delicious Blue Apron cooking battle. We're going to keep cooking Blue Apron, posting the pics, and letting you decide who is the better Blue Apron chef. Also, I want our fans to make sure they check out this week's menu and get their first three meals free from Blue Apron. All they have to do is go to blueapron.com/undisclosed. You're going to love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. Again, all you got to do is go to www.blueapron.com/undisclosed. Blue Apron, it's a better way to cook.
Like we discussed in episode 4, on January 11th, the night Isaac was shot, the police didn't turn up much evidence. Other than the truck itself and that glass window pane, there really wasn't anything they got. Officer Hank Jackson, one of the first two officers on the scene, and Officer Lee Carter, who was sent to do the accident reconstruction, attempted to find where Isaac's truck had crossed the median before crossing into the southbound lane, but they weren't successful, at least according to the report written by Hank Jackson. Isaac's belongings were collected, but returned to his family quickly and apparently without examination by the police. The next day, investigators returned to the crime scene, and that's when they'd find their first piece of evidence that didn't come directly from Isaac's truck. A 9mm shell casing on the side of the road.
Now, Detective Moser's notes show that Lee Carter, the officer, found it off the shoulder of the northbound lane on Highway 27, and that it was about 920 feet south of where Isaac's truck wrecked. The casing was a brass casing. It was 9mm. It was federal brand ammunition, so it was brand name, not government designation. It had been run over. The police did conclude it was connected to Isaac's murder, and this is where it would be really helpful to know exactly where Isaac's truck crossed the Highway 27 median from the northbound lane and then across the southbound lane. We know that it crossed over at some point, but if it crossed over to the far south or the far north of where the casing was found, that could certainly diminish the likelihood that it was actually connected to Isaac's wreck.
Or at least give us some idea of what the connection could have been, because they jumped to the obvious conclusion. There was a shooting, they found a shell casing, ergo, they're connected. But, I mean, look at the pictures from the crime scene in Anand's case. There were 9mm shell casings scattered along Franklintown Road and Lincoln Park, adjacent to where Hayes' body would ultimately be found buried. But they weren't connected. They weren't part of that crime. They were just there. So, could that have happened here as well?
Well, I mean, like you said, I mean, trying to determine where Isaac's truck crossed the road could really help determine whether or not this casing had anything to do with it, right? Because if it crossed too far away from it, then it probably was completely unconnected.
Yeah, and until very recently, at least until a couple months ago, I thought that the police had never found where Isaac's truck left the road or crossed the median or wherever. Because we know from Hank Jackson's notes that they didn't find it on the night of the 11th. His report just actually says, it recounts how they tried to find it, but were not successful. And I figured they'd never found it on a later date because there's no notes about it. They definitely didn't take any photos of where it crossed over. So I just assumed that things were supposed to be this way, that they never found it, so they just couldn't know. The notes as well reference like approximate areas where the truck may have crossed. And Moser's testimony speaks to estimated or approximate areas. And there's one sketchy notation that refers to the casing being found about 500 feet from where the truck left the road. But it's hard to tell if that means that that's where the truck was crashed or where it crossed the median. Anyway, combined with Officer Jackson's report about how they hadn't found it, yeah, I just thought it meant they hadn't reached a conclusion. Which left us with Wayne Benson's testimony and his statements to try and figure out where Isaac's truck had left the road. And according to Benson, Isaac's truck stayed in the median for a remarkably long time before it finally and slowly veered far enough left to cross the southbound lane and flip over in the ditch. He testified, it got into the inside lane and ran the highway, went past one guardrail, then he went past another guardrail, and that second guardrail, the truck veered completely off the highway, and then it, according to Benson, it ran the length of that guardrail and then flipped over at the end.
Yeah, so if we take what Wayne Benson has to say, that would place the crossover point at least 0.23 miles south of where the truck actually wrecked. And that would make sense because Benson himself gave statements about how the events in this incident actually began closer to the coke plant that was on Highway 27. Now, Claire, Joey's attorney at the Georgia Innocence Project, actually spoke to Officer Jackson, the responding officer, this year, and he had a vague memory that maybe at some point they had found the tire marks showing where Isaac's truck had crossed over, but his recollection was the tire marks had been very faint, and he wasn't sure. There was no record. It was 16 years later. And so all of us basically were of the mind that Jackson's memory was really less of a memory and more of an assumption.
We did see where he went across the grass later, but it was after, I think she came up and told us about the window and him being shot. We walked it a couple of times, and then we saw where it's a very light impression. You would think it would be something where you could really see it, but it was a light impression of where they crossed the median.
Oh, so you think you did find that?
Seems like we did. I'm thinking we did. And kind of looked at it going back up through there, and I think we said he traveled a long ways before he did hit something. So that made us think that he may have some faculties to him.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Then a couple months ago, we got the tapes from Mark Free's trial. We didn't have full transcripts, so we didn't actually know what witnesses had said, other than a couple we did have the transcripts for. So I was kind of shocked when I started listening and realized that Officer Lee Carter, who did the reconstruction, or was going to before it was determined to be a murder, had testified at Free's trial. We'd actually interviewed Officer Carter about a month or two before that, but he couldn't remember much this far on. But at Mark's trial, only 2 years after Isaac's death, he'd been able to remember more about the accident, and it turns out that he had found where the truck crossed the median, and that it had been much closer to the ultimate wreck site than previous statements had suggested. Here's Carter at Mark's trial.
Did you find that shell casing?
Yes, I did.
Where did you find that?
On Highway 27, on the edge of the road right there where the picture is taken.
Now, this was on the day after the shooting?
Yes, sir.
Where did you find that in relation to the place that the truck left the roadway?
Exactly where the truck wrecked the roadway.
Well, roughly, within how many feet?
It was 27 feet, roughly.
Well, how do you know 27?
Because the road, I know the distance of the road, and it was on the edge of the road, and it was roughly 27 feet.
Okay. I guess what I'm asking you is, was it parallel, even, with where the truck left the roadway?
Yes, sir. That's about right. It's about parallel with the truck left the roadway.
All right, it wasn't back 100 feet or 200 feet back from where the truck left the roadway?
From when the truck actually first touched the ground, it was back of that, yes, sir.
All right, how far back? That's what I'm asking.
I don't remember that, sir.
Oh, would it have been a short distance, just a little distance, a long distance?
Short distance.
Which totally contradicts Benson's memory and the sketchy notes from Detective Mosier. But Carter was the accident reconstructionist, so I'd normally be inclined to credit his memory, just because this is what he does, what he's familiar with. But he also never provided the prosecution with any written reports, and no reports in the record, although he does reference one in his trial testimony that he had on that date, although apparently it was not entered into the evidence, or at least we don't have today. But it's hard to say if his memory in 2002 is truly accurate, given we have no way to compare it against records, and it doesn't seem to match what we heard from everyone before that. Then again, there are the references in Mosier's notes to a crossover point. Long story short, they may have found it, I guess, and according to Carter, it may have been almost directly parallel to where that shell casing was ultimately found.
Well, I mean, call me a skeptic, but I mean, if there's no documentation prior to this of him having discovered that, and then suddenly this pops up in a trial, I don't know how much weight I would, I don't know. I feel a little bit hesitant to say. To me, it's too convenient to fit with the prosecution's. It's like, oh, it really supports the prosecution's case, right? I mean, they want this casing to be connected to this accident. So, I don't know.
But what's weird to me is they don't use this at Joey's trial. They just have Mosher make statements about how this is approximately where the crossover would have been. And at least at the time, I hadn't read Mosher's testimony to mean he knew where the crossover was, just because from his notes and everything, I'd assumed he hadn't. But for some reason, they changed tactics at Mark's trial and decided to use Lee Carter instead.
I mean, I don't know. In my mind, I'm trying to figure out how in a grassy median, I mean, a truck is not a small vehicle. And if it's kind of lumbering, I mean, there's a couple things that I'm having trouble understanding. Number one is how there's absolutely no evidence of like the tire marks. I mean, you would almost like be able to, I figure, to see almost like a trajectory of the truck going that way. The other thing is these medians dip. If the truck is going kind of slowly, I mean, how does it have the momentum to get up to the other side, go next to a guardrail? I mean, I don't know. And I guess I had to be going fast enough to do that. And I also wonder about Benson's memory that it lingered for a while, because sometimes in these moments, it's just a few seconds, but it feels like a long time.
Yeah, I kind of wonder too about Benson, except for the fact he's not the only one to, he describes this as starting closer to the coke plant. So even if the time dilation was not right in his memory, because that's often how it goes, it's possible he'd at least remember the location of where this all started. And I'd wondered if that's why they hadn't found the crossover point, that it was so far south that they didn't assume it had gone that far and hadn't walked down far enough. But now I don't know what to think. But as for the median, Claire and I went back and forth about that for a while, because it's a pretty deep ditch there. But Hank Jackson helped us figure out how that might have happened.
So how does he cross the median there without crashing?
Well, we have police cars that do it all the time when they do, like, radar, which not as much as they used to, but it's rough on equipment. But see, he's in it looks like a four-wheel drive truck. Uh-huh. So he would have had a clearance to make that.
There must be, like, some kind of software you can use to try to recreate the different scenarios to see, like, how fast the truck had to have been going, where it would have, like, if you have an approximate start point in the crash site.
That's the weird thing. They never did a reconstruction here. I mean, according to Lee Carter, he would have done one. That's what he was sent there to do. But once it became a crime scene, they needed a much more in-depth or thorough report, so he was no longer the one doing it. But it doesn't look like they did anything at all, actually. In general, they did a thorough investigation. This mostly stands out to me because it seems like an aberration. But it wasn't the only piece of ballistics evidence they did find. On January 12th, the day after the shooting, that's when they found this casing on the side of the road. And also that same day, Detective Mosher and another officer named Hill went to inspect Isaac's truck in the Rome Police Department's garage. They took measurements of the seats and the windows and took pictures. And we have their measurements, although a little unclear what they're showing. But he didn't actually collect any at that time. It wasn't until the next day that he found something that had been overlooked in all previous searches. A tiny copper sliver on the driver's side floorboard of Isaac's truck, which was identified as the jacketed portion of a bullet. We have two pictures of it, one close up and one from a distance. And close up one does have a ruler next to it, or a measuring tape. But we were actually not sure, or not certain, for a long time what that photo was showing. Claire and I went back and forth over the fragment, over whether it was supposed to be the bigger oblongish thing, or if it was supposed to be little speckles that were also in the photo, because Claire has gone to the courthouse and held the tin that this jacketed portion of the bullet's in, and she is convinced that there are multiple fragments in there, because when you pick it up, you can hear many pieces shifting. So she assumed from that there was clearly more than one fragment found, maybe.
How come she can't just open it up and look inside?
For evidence reasons. That's actually planned in the future, but so far she has not gotten the court order to do that yet. But in the end, I think we're pretty sure that it is the biggish oblong piece that is the jacket fragment. But that also makes me wonder how it got missed in previous inspections, because it's also smeared with blood and fairly visible.
Well, the only other inspection really was like the night before, right? When they towed before they towed the car away, or maybe after they towed it, I assume.
Well, this was found on the 13th, so 2 days after. There were photos taken and measurements taken on the 12th. And the measurements were of things like the benches, like the window. So someone had to be crawling in the truck, essentially, to get this. But they didn't see this fragment at the time. But that fragment in itself was not identifiable, but it would have been consistent with coming from a 9mm. And we'll get more into the ballistics later. But other than that, the only items that the cops recovered were, in fact, the lead core recovered during Isaac's autopsy. and that's not identifiable. And it could have been from a 9mm, but they could also be from a lot of things. However, altogether, the cops and the prosecutor will argue at trial, a 9mm was used to shoot Isaac.
Now, we'll get into much more detail in a future episode about all of the medical evidence, but the basics here of the bullet entering Isaac's head are this. The bullet was following a slightly upward trajectory, and it entered Isaac's head on the right side of his head, just above the ear, and then again followed a slightly upward trajectory toward the upper left of his head.
Now, we have limited witnesses in this case, at least for the crime itself. There's plenty of non-crime scene witnesses, as we'll get into later. But in addition to Wayne Benson, there were a few other motorists at the scene, although none of them saw anything that seemed to be hugely significant, at least not in terms of identifying the killer. Benson's obviously of most interest, and he was spoken to many times by Detective Mosier, although it doesn't appear that the Floyd County police ever followed up with him. But Benson's first statements about the blue car didn't come until the next day when Mosier called him. He didn't apparently mention it at the crime scene, because at the time it just looked like Isaac had drifted off the road. And although Benson remembered the blue car instantly when he learned that it was a shooting, well, as far as we know, he didn't bring it up to the police at the scene itself. And Benson's statements do evolve a little over time, and it's kind of unavoidable, I guess, based on the number of interviews he gave. But he's always stuck to the basic description of the car. Small, four doors, like a Honda. Bluish, he thinks navy blue, with noticeable antenna. He also thinks it's kind of sporty, although I'm not sure what kind of sporty would have meant to Mr. Benson.
Then we have Mark Rayford and Tammy Penny. They were both in the southbound lane of Highway 27, so keep in mind, Isaac's in the northbound lane, they're driving south on the other side of 27, and neither of them saw much beyond the headlights of a vehicle that was suddenly coming toward them as it crossed over the median going the wrong way on the highway. Both of them do remember that they stopped to try and assist the driver. They gave statements on January 12th and 13th after Detective Mosier had called them. One thing, though, that both of them mentioned is that there was a white Cutlass that had also been on the scene and in general proximity to Isaac's truck at the time of the accident. Now, in terms of that white Cutlass, we don't know too much. We know that its driver might have been named John. While Officer Jackson doesn't remember speaking with any witnesses that night, and he doesn't remember being told a white Cutlass was on the scene, listen to his conversation with Claire about a report from the scene, referencing Mark and Tammy saying they saw something hit the windshield of the Cutlass as it approached the crash scene. He has an interesting theory about what the object could have been.
Well, the part of this that I'm interested in is this down here where it says, white Cutlass was in front of them, so this is in front of Tammy
right.
Penny. And she thinks a part of his truck, meaning Dawkins' truck, hit the white Cutlass. And what I'm wondering is specifically about this part of his truck hitting the white Cutlass.
I think that the person driving the Cutlass don't want to talk to police. Yeah, I don't know. I don't. That doesn't ring a bell.
But you didn't find anything. What I'm wondering is what it is that hit the Cutlass.
I'll tell you what it could be. And it's just from a police officer's standpoint. It could be a shell casing. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, they reportedly found the shell casing on the other side of the road.
Yeah, see, I wasn't there for that because they went back down.
Yeah, that was the next day. 366 feet south of the profile sign.
But see, so, you know, 366 feet sounds like a long ways, but if you're traveling like 60 miles an hour,
yeah, no, far. No. I've driven
it.
But if it's not the shell casing, can you think of anything else it might?
So other than that, I have no idea.
It's hard to see what could have broken off Isaac's truck to hit the white Cutlass's windshield. And maybe it was a casing, but there's a wide median there, so I'm not convinced the second shot could have gotten flung that far to hit the Cutlass. And we don't know anything else about it, because we assume that Michael Taylor, the other officer on the scene, was the one who took witness statements, because Hank Jackson thinks he was out walking the lanes looking for evidence or trying to figure where the crossover point was. So he wouldn't have been the one actually talking to Tammy, Penny, and Mark Rayford and Wayne Benson. But if that's the case, Michael Taylor didn't write down anything about this John of the White Cutlass. So we don't have much to go on in terms of finding him. But if there's anyone out there, maybe named John, who was driving a white Cutlass southbound on Highway 27 on January 11th, 2000, about 7:15 p.m., we'd love to hear from you. One other thing I wonder that it could have been that hit the white Cutlass's windshield. Could there have been a second gunshot? This time, one that either missed Isaac's truck or perhaps was aimed at another car?
So there's another witness named Beatrice Goss, who is actually an ear witness. And Ms. Goss was at home, not far from this incident. She was about to watch television, and she was watching television, but she heard what she thought were shots. She heard two shots from the direction of the coke plant, and they were not too far apart from each other, like in succession maybe. She was a distance away from the wreck, but she was kind of close to where Benson places the shots happening.
Yeah, she, based on the time that JAG came on, which she was waiting to watch, she estimated the shots were a little after 7 p.m. that night. And if we're to rely on her testimony, which, again, seems fairly credible, the only question would be whether she could have heard the gunshots if they actually happened closer to where the wreck ultimately was. The police credit her, and I'm inclined to as well, that she heard two shots that night, which would suggest that there was another shot fired, in addition to the one that hit Isaac's truck.
So there's not a lot to go on to from here. You've got the casing, you've got a fragment from the jacket, and you've got a few witnesses. And now the police have to try and connect all of that to a suspect. We're going to take a short break now to talk about one of our sponsors this week, The Great Courses Plus. Now, you've heard me talk about them before, and you've even heard me talk about the course that I'm in the middle of taking right now, but it's such a fantastic and fascinating series that I had to tell you about it again. It's called Forensic History, Crimes, Frauds, and Scandals. There are 24 video lectures in this series, so every week I watch a few of them. And even though I thought I'd seen it all when it comes to how broken the criminal justice system is, well, it looks like there is still room to be surprised and horrified. This week, I watched the episode titled Crooked Cops and Bad Convictions. Shouldn't surprise you that this subject would interest me in particular. Professor Elizabeth Murray does a masterful job of presenting three real and shocking case studies showing how misconduct by the police ends up in wrongful convictions. Bad policing is not always about a conspiracy. Sometimes it's just a few bad apples. Sometimes it's just one. This series has a ton to offer, from medical forensics such as body decomposition to analysis of some of the most infamous crimes ever: bank robberies, sports doping, Lizzie Borden, and even Jack the Ripper. But if true crime and forensics is not your thing, though I bet it is, The Great Courses Plus offers hundreds of other courses on demand across nearly every platform and taught by top professors and experts. And right now, as one of our listeners, you get a special offer. 1 free month, unlimited access to all of the lectures. I'm not talking about a few lectures here. I'm talking about unlimited access to every single lecture, every single course they offer. So start your free month today by going to thegreatcoursesplus.com/undisclosed. Again, that's thegreatcoursesplus.com/undisclosed. Benson, the eyewitnesses who saw the wreck that night and told the police about the weird interaction between Isaac's truck and another car right before the crash, the Rome Police Department knew that their shooter had likely been in a small four-door sedan, something Benson thought was like a Honda or a Hyundai. From the casing they found on the side of the road, they knew that their shooter had likely used a 9mm handgun to commit the murder. So here's the next steps. They have to first figure out what little blue Honda-ish car Joey could have been driving. And two, figure out how he might have gotten access to a 9mm. So the Rome police took immediate steps to do both in the days following Isaac's death.
Step one, find the bluish, Honda-ish, sedan-ish car that Joey could have been driving. Also, figure out how he could have been driving this bluish, Honda-ish car when he had in fact left his house in a white truck and shown up in Cedartown in a white truck about 40 minutes later. Initially, there was a great deal of excitement over Tandy's little greenish-tealish Pontiac Sunfire, the one Detective Mosier saw at the Watkins house when he went to try and interview Joey on January 12th. A few days after that, he actually went back to their house and took some pictures of both Joey's truck and the Sunfire they could use later at trial. Now, a teal Sunfire is a small sedan that could have been seen as bluish in the dark, so Mosier took those photos of Tandy's car, and with the hopes of making an ID, he went to show them to Benson. Unfortunately, that turned out to be a dead end.
In the course of your investigation, did you show Mr. Benson, when you talked with him, any photographs of a blue car?
I did not show him. He was shown, but not by me. Let me take that back. I showed him one set of pictures I had. Yes, he was shown on two different occasions, one by me and then one by someone else.
Right.
So, yes, sir.
And did you show him Tandy Watkins' car, Joey Watkins?
Yes, I did.
And he told you that was not the car that he saw out there that night, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
And you put that in your report, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
And that's unequivocally?
Yes.
His statement. And did you show him other blue cars?
He was shown others by another detective, yes.
In fact, they would eventually compile an entire photo album of blue cars taken around the Rome area. Our bluish cars, bluish Hondas, basically every little four-ish door car that the photographer saw, they took a photo and put it in a book and gave it to Benson. He did not find any that he thought looked like the car he saw that night, although there was one older model Civic, I think, which he seemed to think was close, although according to the notes, it wasn't quite right either.
I would assume that the way they would do this is to like pull DMV records and see how many like little blue Hondas or similar cars are registered, and you know, collect that information, then see if there's any suspects that make sense there. Is that like kind of the route they took, like pull records and then, or did they just randomly take pictures of cars around town?
We don't know how they did that. And we've seen the photo album. It's still in the police department's files. But other than the fact someone took those photos and showed them to Benson, we don't know anything else. And there are a lot of small blue sedans in the world and a lot in Rome. So it didn't give them too much to go on.
I would think that if they were to pull DMV records, I mean, especially if he started with a Honda, because it seems interesting that he specifically mentioned Honda. Maybe it looked like, you know, a certain shape of the car. I mean, maybe they'd come up with a couple dozen, maybe three or four dozen at the most. And that doesn't seem like a whole lot to start with. I mean, unless we're talking about, you know, if it's like a big city, maybe thousands and thousands. But I can't imagine it would be more than a couple hundred in an area like this.
Well, one thing they did do is they went to Floyd College and pulled the parking records there, because the students had to have parking passes. So they went through that and pulled every single small kind of bluish car. And there were a lot of those. So I think that caused them to give up on that route.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
So that takes us next to step two, which is to find a 9mm handgun that Joey could have been using. The problem with that is that Joey only owned hunting rifles and shotguns, and he wasn't in possession of a 9mm that anyone seemed to know of. Detective Mosier, during the course of investigation, did hear rumors about how Joey owned a handgun at some point, although it's not clear when, but really that's all his investigation uncovered. Nothing sufficient to hang the case on, just a story hearsay about Joey maybe having access to an unidentified handgun at some point in the previous year. That said, by the time the case got to trial, the state would present evidence that Joey did in fact have a secret 9mm, and that in fact he'd bought it not long before Isaac's death. So where did this evidence come from? Well, it came from the exact same witness who was the source of all of the rumors about Joey owning a handgun that Moser had heard. It's just that when Moser talked to this witness, he gave a very different story from what would eventually be told to the Floyd County Police. Here's what Moser found in his investigation. Sometime on January 12th, Moser spoke to Breanne, who told him that while at the hospital waiting for updates on Isaac, a friend of Joey's named Adam Elrod showed up. And according to Breanne, Adam told her that Joey had bought a handgun in Cedarton.
Had you ever seen him with any handguns?
No, sir, I haven't, but Adam told me that he had purchased one in Cedartown or something like that. I don't know. I don't know.
When did he purchase it?
I don't know. That's, I can't.
A gun, a handgun or a rifle?
A handgun.
Okay.
You might want to ask him about that because I really don't know. He told me at the hospital when I was up there with Samantha and her family and Isaac, and I was just so out of it then I couldn't tell you what.
That's Adam Elrod, right?
Yes, sir.
So Breanne doesn't really know much in the way of details, right? I mean, she doesn't know when Joey supposedly bought this gun. She has no idea how Adam knows that Joey bought a handgun in Cedartown. And she later tells Stanley Sutton of Floyd County Police Department that she's not sure if Adam told her Joey had actually bought the gun or if he tried to buy a gun. So as a result of speaking to Breanne and her boyfriend at the time, Chad Redden, Moser then interviewed Adam, who told him that he saw a handgun in Joey's truck about 9 months earlier, in June of 1989, and that it was possible that it was a 9mm, but he has no idea where Joey got it from. And that's it. No guns ever found, and Moser didn't learn anything more about this rumored handgun in the course of the 7 weeks that he was the lead on the case. But a year and a half later, though, at trial, a very different version of events are going to be told. Adam testifies to something radically different. He says that sometime when it was turning colder in the fall, October, November, he and Joey drove to Cedartown to cruise around and try and pick up some girls. And while there, Joey said he needed to meet someone, so Adam dropped him off at a gas station where he met with a scraggly man with a beard.
Where he needed to be let out at. I pulled up right in there.
And this was in Cedartown.
This was in Cedartown. I pulled out right there, let him out. Well, I seen this truck there. It's reddish, like a reddish looking truck. It was sort of a light colored, looked like somebody spray painted, really. And seen somebody sort of like standing off to the side of the building over there. Looked like he was smoking a cigarette. He was sort of scraggly looking, you know, like we talked about. And
Do you remember telling me he had a beard and dark hair?
Yeah, he sort of had a real thick goatee, real wide goatee. Joey got out of the car, sort of like as he was walking up, I was steadily pulling off.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you go up there to the stop sign, you take a left, you go back, and you know, he told me, he said it was going to take me about 5 or 6 minutes. So I rode all the way back down to Kroger, come all the way back. Well, I sort of pulled up there real, when I turned the corner, I pulled around real easy.
Mm-hmm.
And he's went, Robbie's windows are tinted. You know, you can't really see out. Well, I cracked the window about halfway, and the door just opened. You know, I never did see him. He jumped in the truck. We got a handle right here. Pulled himself up. He pulled the gun out right here and stuck it up under the console. There's a real wide console in the new Fords.
Mm-hmm.
He stuck it up under it. You know, nothing was really said.
Now, you'd think that this testimony from Adam could have been impeached easily by the defense by pointing out how radically different Adam's new story was, how different it was from his initial claims about having no idea where Joey could have gotten a gun. After all, Moser told the defense about his interview with Adam before the trial, so they knew about it. But Adam found an ingenious way to avoid impeachment. He simply claimed to have no memory at all of ever giving any prior statements.
Question. And you told every bit of this to Detective Moser when he came to talk to you about this a day or two after the... Answer. Hold on. I don't know who this is. Detective who? Question. Moser. Do you not remember talking to a Detective Moser on January 14th? Answer. The only person I remember saying anything to was Stanley Sutton.
Well, but
Okay, I have to laugh about this. I mean, even though maybe it's an ingenious way for him to just conveniently forget what he had said, why does it mean that the defense still can't impeach him? Because they actually have, they have the officer himself, Moser, saying that we had this conversation. They have, you know, notes of this conversation.
Well, no notes. I just know what Moser told them.
There's no notes. And so that's why.
Well, there are notes, but they didn't have them.
So that's why they couldn't impeach him.
Well, they bring Moser on. I mean, the defense drops the attempted impeachment during Adams' testimony and ends cross-examination. But they tried to bring Detective Moser back, who'd already testified earlier, during their case. But the result was kind of uninspiring. The defense tried to ask Moser about Adams' interview, and Moser confirmed that it happened and that, no, Adam hadn't mentioned anything in particular about trip to Cedartown or the shadowy goateed guy. And Moser did confirm that Adam was giving different dates than he seemed to before. But he didn't really claim a contradiction, necessarily, between what Adam had said to him back in January of 2000 and what he was saying at trial in 2001.
Yeah, and so here's the question and answer to Moser when he's called back to the stand. Question, how did he, meeting Adam, appear to be responding to your questions? I mean, did he just go off and tell you just everything you ever wanted to know, or just answer, well, if you were asking if he was elaborating, no. I didn't get really a lot of people that elaborated anything. Yes, I may have failed in that respect of asking a more thorough questioning. For that, I take, of course, responsibility, but he would answer, I guess, when I asked.
So Moser deflected and excused Adam's initial and completely contradictory statements as a result of Moser's own failures in questioning. I mean, Moser just asked the wrong questions to Adam. Perhaps if he'd done a better job, Adam would have come out with his full story from the start.
It's hard for me to accept that a detective who was looking for evidence to connect a suspect to a gun would not ask questions like, do you know if he owned it? And did you know? I mean, that what other kind of questioning would he have done? It would have been something along those lines. And I can't imagine, unless for some reason Adam and I don't, you know, maybe we should explore the relationship between Adam and Joey, that maybe Adam was kind of trying to, cover for Joey at the time and wasn't fully forthcoming in the early investigation.
If he's trying to cover for Joey, why is he immediately going to the hospital to blab Brianne? By the way, Joey has a gun of some sort.
So simply put, overall, this was a really big missed opportunity in this trial, likely the result of the state not turning over Moser's notes of this interview with Adam Elrod, because it's well established in jurisdictions across the country, including Georgia, that if you have a witness, they've testified to one thing at trial, they've made a prior inconsistent statement, and they're testifying on the stand, I don't even remember making that prior statement, you can use that prior statement both to impeach their testimony at trial, show it's not trustworthy, but also show if this is a person claiming, I don't even remember talking to a detective, and you have notes from that statement, you can prove this is a person with a bad memory, and their testimony is not especially reliable. So again, you can't really lay blame at the feet of the defense, but for whatever reason in this case, proper impeachment didn't take place, and the jury was probably left with an impression of Adam Elrod that was much higher than it could have been. You know that feeling you get when you can get things done with just the click of your mouse? It can't get more convenient than that. And now, you can even get your mailing and shipping done without leaving your desk, thanks to Stamps.com. Stamps.com turns your PC or Mac into your own personal post office that never closes. It's so convenient. You can buy and print official US postage for any letter or package right from your computer and printer. Then, you just hand the mail to your mailman or drop it in the mailbox. You'll never have to go to the post office again. I'm always sending out articles to colleagues, lawyers, and judges. I'm making requests to courts for documents. And using Stamps.com is so easy and saves me so much time. And right now, you can sign up for Stamps.com and use our promo code UNDISCLOSED for this special offer. It's a 4-week trial, plus a $110 bonus offer, including postage and a digital scale. So don't wait. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in undisclosed. That's stamps.com, enter undisclosed.
So at this point in the investigation, the Rome Police Department couldn't link Joey to the probable car that the killer drove. They really couldn't link him to the probable weapon the killer used to shoot Isaac, other than some of the rumors that Adam had mentioned. And they had no other eye or ear witnesses that could provide some kind of information that might link Joey directly to the scene. But what they had no problem finding, though, were a lot of whispered rumors about all kinds of terrible things Joey might have done. And the worst of these rumors involved the death of Isaac's dog the previous year.
The night Isaac was shot, Isaac's family and friends told detectives about how, 3 to 5 months back, Isaac's dog had been killed. As far as the notes show, no one initially accused Joey of killing the dog at the time, or at least that accusation is not reflected in the notes the detectives took. But it didn't take long before those claims would start. In fact, Joey allegedly killing Isaac's dog, and Joey's alleged involvement in the Panama City incident, would be the two major pieces of evidence against Joey that the Rome police cited in their write-up of the case when they handed it over to the Floyd County police. Eventually, the state would also throw out a claim that Joey had killed another dog, or had someone else kill it for him, although that came as a mid-trial surprise for the defense. Taken together, the dogs would become the most important evidence used against Joey, and I don't use the phrase most important piece of evidence lightly. I didn't always think that, and in early conversations with Joey, he described how, during his trial, he felt as if the trial had been going his way until the dog stuff came out, and that suddenly everything started to turn very, very bad. He could feel the mood in the courtroom change, he said, and that the jurors wouldn't even look his way anymore. I kind of dismissed Joey's impression of how the dog stuff had affected his case. None of the dog deaths even occurred close to the time of Isaac's murder, and the evidence supposedly linking Joey to any of it was so lame that I could barely muster up an eye roll. It was all so convoluted and bizarre, and the connection to Joey so tenuous, that it was hard to focus attention on it. Besides, how was Joey supposed to disprove claims that he killed a dog 17 years ago, when there's nothing tangible supporting those claims in the first place? In terms of investigation priorities, it seemed low just because how am I going to prove he killed a dog in 1999? But then I spoke to people who'd been involved in the case back in 2001, and I finally came to understand why the dogs mattered. Why they're probably the reason, or a very big reason, why Joey's in prison today. Because the dogs were, in effect, a substitute for motive. Joey killing Isaac didn't make any sense from the perspective of a normal human being. The timing, the rationale, none of it fits. There was no way for the prosecution to hide that fact either. I mean, the dates of when people had dated and stopped dating and what they were doing at the time of the murder, that was all fact that they couldn't get around. So they couldn't just use a normal jealous lover theory here, because normal jealous lovers don't act like that. That's where the dogs came in to save the day. Joey hated Isaac so much, they said, that he killed Isaac's dog. And that kind of hatred explains why he committed an otherwise motiveless murder. Here's one juror we spoke to, describing her thoughts on the dog evidence.
That doesn't make him a killer, but it makes him a really weird person. I mean, something's messed up in his head. Who does that? I mean, you know, and that shows the extent of hatred. And that, to me, is the motive, the hatred he had. It went on for a long time, and it got worse and worse and worse. He couldn't stand it. He even had a new girlfriend. Why is he worrying about this other girl? And the guy went on 3 dates for her. I think it was 3. And that was it. He didn't mess with her anymore.
In addition to providing a band-aid for the prosecution's motive issues, the dog claims have the double benefit of poisoning everyone against Joey's case before they even know about it. Back in December, when I first started investigating the case, when I talked to people I knew about the new case we were working on and what it was about, if I mentioned that some of the accusations include claims that Joey had killed someone's dog, there was a common reaction I got over and over again. That small sucking in of breath, a short, oh. Someone said Joey killed Isaac's dog? Is it too late for you to do another case? I mean, if he's accused of murder, that's one thing, but... And if I had any doubts about how devastating these allegations were for Joey, the podcast has made it clear. The fact that Joey was accused of killing a dog has resulted in a pretty fierce backlash. Email, social media, a lot of people writing in to say that they don't care if Joey killed Isaac, why are we defending a dog killer? Or, just FYI, dog killers are usually psychopaths, so he probably did this too. Or, are you sure you want to be defending Joey? I mean, the dog thing. Which goes to show how brutal and how insidious this prosecution tactic really was. Just the allegation that Joey killed a dog destroyed any chance he'd ever had at a fair trial. But beyond that, it continues to damn him to this day by causing people to shut down and turn away from his case before hearing out the facts.
So that's how the dogs eventually were used at Joey's trial. At the start of the case, back at the beginning, when the Rome Police Department first began their investigation, there was really no indication the dogs would play any role at all. In fact, it seemed like it'd be a non-issue. So here are the basics. Here's what we know about Isaac's dog from the testimony at trial. Her name was Sally. She was a black and tan coon hound that he used for hunting, and she was known for digging holes and climbing fences and being a bit of a Houdini dog, who would go and basically chase the neighbor's cows when she did get out. Now, according to Isaac's father, Isaac did everything he could to keep her from escaping, which is why he kept her chained even when she was in her pen. Then, sometime in the fall of 1999, it's not exactly clear when, a lot of witnesses gave a lot of different dates, Isaac came home to find that Sally was dead, still chained up in her pen. She'd been shot in the head. Now, at trial, Tammy Colston told the jury that Joey was the one who had killed Isaac's dog as an act of revenge, and that he was so proud of what he'd done that he couldn't help but brag about it. In fact, in closing argument, she said, "There were so many people that knew Joey Watkins killed that dog, and I guarantee you he is kicking himself right now because I guarantee you he went out bragging about it. And that is why there are so many people that knew it. He was bragging about it. He wanted people to know that he had killed Sally, Isaac Dawkins' beloved pet. He is proud of that. He is proud of that. He is proud of that."
It should be noted that, in reality, the so many people the prosecutor Tammy Colston references actually consists of precisely one witness at Joey's trial who ever claimed that Joey had confessed to killing the dog. And that one witness had actually recanted the statement before the trial, testifying that Joey had never said anything of the sort, that he made it up based on rumors he'd heard. So at the time of Isaac's death, there doesn't seem to have been anyone or anything that linked Joey to the killing of Isaac's dog. In fact, on January 14th, just 2 days after Isaac's death, Moser had his first interview with Breanne, for which he took notes. And these notes show, and I quote, "Breanne said victim did not think Joey shot his dog." Shortly after her interview with Moser, though, Breanne's story apparently changed, because suddenly people all around town were hearing that Joey had shot Isaac's dog, and Breanne was the one who told them. Here's what Breanne's friend Jessica told the police during her interview in October, 9 months later.
Any other information about rumors or whatever you heard throughout the community?
Just that Isaac's dog had gotten shot. That's it.
Do you know who shot Isaac's dog?
I was told that it was Joey.
Who told you?
Breanne.
How did Breanne know?
She said that Isaac told her.
Isaac told her. Okay.
But Detective Moser's investigation never actually turned up any evidence beyond these types of rumors. And Joey has always denied any connection between him and Sally's death.
What did Breanne tell you back then about the dogs? You knew about it. You knew the rumors or heard something about it.
Yeah. Before that, I didn't even know he had a dog, you know. And she called me up and she asked me, she's like, "You know anything about Isaac's dog getting killed?" And I was like, "What?" And I was like, "No, I don't know anything about it." And there was a conversation about the dog, and she told me, she was like, "Well, he knows who did it anyway. The neighbors, it kept getting in the trash or whatever it was doing, running the cows or whatever." Said the neighbor actually shot his dog. That's what Breanne told me. They thought the neighbors had done it.
And it seems like it's what Breanne told Moser, too.
They knew I did not kill his dog. He even knew I didn't kill his dog.
She was going around telling everyone that you did, unfortunately.
Yeah, she knew better.
Now, you may be wondering why the fact that Breanne said that Isaac didn't think Joey killed his dog didn't come out at trial. Well, in part, it's because, again, Moser's notes were never provided to the defense. Until Claire obtained the police file in October 2015, no one outside the state had seen Moser's notes or knew about Breanne's denial that Isaac thought Joey had done it. Once Claire learned of it, though, she decided to try to speak to Breanne, but Breanne was less than enthusiastic about talking to Claire.
I just kept saying, you know, "So would you like to talk to me in the future? I can come to you." "No, the only thing that your call has taught me is that I should change my phone number, and I can't believe this, and blah, blah." And then, so I tried again, and I was like, "Look, I really just want to know one thing. I've spoken with Detective Moser, I've looked at his police notes, and his notes, and he personally says that you told him that Isaac Dawkins told you that Isaac did not believe that Joey shot his dog. Can you please tell me about that conversation? Is that correct?" And she had this long pause, and I thought she might answer me. I was really hopeful she would answer me. And then she says, "I'll be contacting the district attorney's office."
And I said, okay. And I said, I have spoken with them already, so that they do, it won't be a surprise to them that I'm calling you, but if you feel free. And she said, the district attorney of LaGrange? And I said, no, I was, Floyd County's the one I talked to. I'll be contacting the district attorney of LaGrange.
Okay, you do that.
Goodbye. And she hung up.
That's the long and short of what the Rome Police Department found against Joey. Maybe they could link him to a 9mm gun, although probably not. Maybe they could link him to the shooting of Isaac's dog, although probably not. Really no evidence whatsoever that he ever had possession of a smallish, bluish, Honda-ish car. And that goes a long way to explaining something that happened toward the end of Detective Moser's investigation.
Yeah, because at some point during the course of his 7-week investigation, Detective Moser determined that Joey was not a viable suspect in Isaac's murder. And in fact, at some point, Moser wrote a letter stating that Joey Watkins had actually been eliminated as a possible suspect in the case. And the best we can determine, this was written at the request of Joey's attorney to help Joey in applying for a job he was trying to get at the time. The letter wasn't saved, though, so we don't exactly know what it said. In fact, we only very recently learned that it even existed, and through an extremely convoluted path.
In October 2000, 1 month before Joey's arrest, Joey was dating a new girl named Kelly, and they had gotten pretty serious. In fact, they'd moved in together. Stanley Sutton found out about it, and he and another SCPD officer went to Kelly's parents' house to interview Kelly and her father, and to talk to them about the case. Although interview is probably the wrong word for it, because the real purpose seems to have been to convince Kelly and her father that Joey would probably kill her if she kept dating him, so she shouldn't do that, and to tell them about all the bad things Joey had done, or supposedly done. But as it turns out, we actually have a recording of this interview. Now, the police didn't record it, or even write down much about it beyond one note, which we'll discuss in a moment, but Kelly's father had wanted to be prepared for the interview. And he'd spoken to Joey, sat down with him, and said, I want to hear your side of the story, if you're going to date my daughter. And then he talked to the police and wanted to make sure that he could know what they'd said and to have a record of it, he decided to tape it. And he's hung on to this tape for the past 16 years. When we listened to it, we were startled to hear the following exchange. In it, Kelly describes seeing a letter which purported to officially clear Joey as a suspect, and Kelly's father asked the Floyd County officers about it. The clip starts with Kelly's dad, and he's saying, wait, what's this letter? A letter that cleared Joey as a suspect? And then you can hear officers Shiflett and Sutton responding.
Did you say you saw the letter?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have a letter.
And what was supposed to be on the letter?
I'm not sure if they can shut it from the other. They dated the same girl as Brienne. They broke up. We've proven the fact that they've had words together. They fought. Matter of fact, Adam went to his house one time. He was chased down by Joey, several months prior to that. And isn't it a coincidence to you that Joey's on the same highway, same day that Isaac is shot?
I met a lot of other people, Martina.
When I first heard this, I could not believe at first that I was hearing it right. Not only does Kelly say that she's seen a letter that cleared Joey as a suspect, but Sutton and Shiflett jump in and confirm it exists. Yeah, it's from the city police. It's from Jim Moser. It says that he eliminated Joey as a suspect. And then we have Sutton adding in, yeah, Moser did eliminate him as a suspect, but Moser's gotta be crazy. That seemed like confirmation that this letter existed if the Floyd County police were willing to tell a witness, oh yeah, it's real. And I had seen other references to the letter in the files. At one point, Aslan mentions it as well. But one of Sutton's reports states that he'd asked Moser about the letter, and Moser had told him he didn't know anything about it. so I'd assumed it didn't exist. That either Aslan had misunderstood, or maybe Joey had lied to her about the letter. I mean, a secret police letter that says you're not a suspect seems like a not a real thing, right? But the letter was real. Mosher had indeed written it, and according to Shiflett and Sutton, they were aware of it. But that raises a new question. If there's a letter from the police that cleared Joey's a suspect, then how come we were only learning of it now? Months and months in investigation, 16 years after the trial. I still don't know the answer to that, but Claire was able to confirm with Joey's trial attorney that, yeah, Mosher had written the letter, although they're not sure where it is now.
That's a really unusual thing for police to do, right? I mean, I don't think I've ever heard of that in another case.
It's so unusual because it is something that could be used at trial. Now, it wasn't used here, obviously, but to have an official statement from a police department that's investigated the case for several weeks saying, we've cleared you as a suspect, I mean, you present that to a jury, and you can imagine as a juror, that's almost automatic reasonable doubt. So I would love to know the thought process of Mosher when he wrote this letter and what exactly led him to conclude we're writing him off as a suspect and basically wiping our hands clean.
Well, I would like to know the thought process of the trial attorneys who didn't present that letter, if they knew of its existence back then.
Yeah, agreed.
Well, regardless, Joey's status as a non-suspect didn't last very long, because on February 28th, the Rome Police Department received word that there was going to be a change in how the investigation was proceeding. The Floyd County Police would be taking over. And here's the letter from Chief Free from the Floyd County Police Department that was written to the Rome Police.
We were asked by the family of Isaac Dawkins to become involved in the investigation of this case. I have asked Captain Tommy Shiflett to assign Sergeant Stanley Sutton full-time to work on the case. Sergeant Sutton will furnish on a daily basis any information that he receives in the case, and if he should develop enough information to prosecute someone, he will turn that information over to the Rome Police Department for arrest and prosecution. We do not want to grandstand, and we do not want to create any ill will between the two departments. Mr. Dawkins said that he would just like for someone else to look at the case and see if they can spot something that would lead us to a successful conclusion. Sergeant Sutton was chosen because he's one of the best criminal investigators, and he has ties to the family.
So as of February 28th, now that Floyd County has taken over, Joey's status as a non-suspect is over. From that day forward, he is going to be the only suspect, along with whatever accomplice was popular with the investigators at the moment. Stanley Sutton came into the case convinced that Joey was the culprit and spent the next 8 months creating the case to prove it. It seems clear that by the end of their investigation, the Rome Police Department had crossed Joey off their suspect list. They seemed to realize there really wasn't any evidence connecting him to the crime, other than rumors and conjecture. But it wasn't just that. It was also the fact that in those 7 weeks, other possible suspects were coming out of the woodwork. Next time on Undisclosed.
Wraps up episode 6 of the second season of Undisclosed. Thanks for coming along for the ride, everyone. Hey, before we get into the credits, I mentioned at the beginning of the episode that I've got a favor to ask of our fans, and here it is. Undisclosed wants to host a panel at South by Southwest 2017. We're calling that panel Podcasting for Social Justice Radicals. Basically, Robbie and I want to get up there and tell the world how we go about developing Undisclosed and why we believe podcasting can be a powerful medium for achieving social justice change. In order to get that panel, we need fans to vote for it. So here's how you can do so. We need you to go to www.panelpicker.sxsw.com/vote/67597. That's going to take you to the Undisclosed South by Southwest panel picker page. You're going to be able to see videos from Robbie and I and read about our proposal. Again, here's the website. I know it's complicated. Just bear with me. It's www.panelpicker.sxsw.com/vote/67597. The other way you can go about getting there is by going to panelpicker.sxsw.com and then doing a search, and you can either search for Undisclosed or the title of our panel, which will be Podcasting for Social Justice Radicals. You go there, you find our page, you sign up for an account, and you can cast your vote. South by Southwest is going to pick the best panel presentations in part based on how often you guys vote for us. We really need your support. We're going to be promoting it on social media. Undisclosed really wants to do this again because we believe in the power of podcasting and we believe in the power of our fans to help us affect social change by listening to podcasts and going out there and pressing for the reform. So vote for us. We promise we won't disappoint you. It'll be a great panel and hopefully you'll be able to either attend or watch it online. That said, thank you. And here come the credits. As always, we want to thank the Georgia Innocence Project for bringing us Joey's case. You can learn more about the Georgia Innocence Project at their website, www.georgiainnocenceproject.org. Our great sponsors this week, Blue Apron, Stamps.com, and The Great Courses. Thank you, as always. Support our sponsors. They support us. Ramiro Marquez on the music, along with Patrick Cortez, Baluki on our logo, Nina Mooser, and Christy Williams on our website, and People Maps, brought to you by Heidi Phelps at the Undisclosed webpage. That's www.undisclosed-podcast.com. Rebecca Lavoy of Partners in Crime Media and the podcast Crime Writers On makes the show sound great. She gets her help from Hannah McCarthy and Brooke Giddings. Brooke's of the Actual Innocence podcast. Don't forget to check that out. It's a great podcast. We love it. Methil Telhan does everything, like literally everything, just short of reading these credits into the microphone. Thank you, Methil. You're great. And to our listeners, thank you. We appreciate you very, very, very much. Thanks for listening. You can follow the show online at our handle, Undisclosed Pod. You can follow us on Twitter, you can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, all those happy places, and make sure that you drive the conversation on social media. Here's some other news. I'm going to be hosting the Addendum this week. You can help me make sure I don't screw it up by coming up with some really interesting questions for Twitter. If you've got interesting questions, we won't have to rely on my boring ones. All you have to do to ask questions is tweet with the hashtag UDAddendum. We'll find the best ones and ask them on air. So for now, Dennis Robinson is your executive producer. Is he also a good host? I don't know. We'll find out Thursday. Until then.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at IPVanish.com/audio.